This is Lee Roloff, Surprising Psyche, March 8th, 2002.
It's interesting how this title came about. It was not my first choice. My original intent, when asked almost a year ago now, when March 8th, 2002, seemed in the indefinite future, and then shaped by the outer events in our culture, my original intent was to explore how psyche terrorizes. And you all have been terrorized. We have all been terrorized by dreams, events. But then two things happened, of course, 9/11. And then my former analyst and friend, June Singer, herself, used the topic of psyche and terror for her lecture here last month. So I began reflecting on how surprising psyche is. And what our reactions are to being surprised. And one day last month, I realized that the title itself was a pun. I was surprised by my own title. I asked myself, can we come upon ourselves in such a way and surprise ourselves? The answer, yes. And I asked myself, does psyche herself surprise us? And the answer, of course, is yes. And so, the two elements came together for tonight's explorations and tomorrow's workshopping with psyche. Well, while in the preliminary stages of preparation for tonight's comments, I found amongst my scattered papers the following. Actually, it was an Anosand who brought it to me, and I had tucked it in a leather holder. And what I had tucked in this leather holder, and it fell out to confront me, was the question, how to make God laugh? Answer. Make a plan. And I thought, yes, this is my dilemma. If I make a plan, and I don't veer from this plan tonight, I am in the situation psychologically of being surprised myself and making God laugh. And I realize that I have to be in and with psyche in every moment of the presentation, or, and the thought was quite real, I am a fraud. So, just to be completely honest, I'm placing myself at risk for you, and for the benefit of the topic, willing to process with you, and perhaps you with me. So, are we ready? The task at hand. I was giving just such a lecture a few years ago in one of my classes at Northwestern. And I looked up like this, and confronting me, staring into my eyes, scrunching her nose, was what I will, for the lack of a better word, say, a sweet young woman. Now, to be honest with you, when I first wrote this, I wrote thing. We've just got to keep clear here amongst ourselves. And I went back and I said, that's sexist, and I've got to change that. So I did, but I was really thinking thing. That in front of me was this sweet young thing. I paused, and I looked at her, and I said, do you have a question? And she replied without a scintilla of hesitation, yes, I do. Just what is psyche? What are you talking about? And I knew I had to answer her question then and there, and had to answer it directly, imaginally, and above all things, honestly. And Psyche came to my rescue, for I heard myself answer. And note what I just said carefully. I used the passive voice. I heard myself say, I did not answer her. The I heard myself speak spontaneously. And I said to her, well, do you know what a lava lamp is? And she said, yes. Well, inside the glass container is a form that only comes to life when heat is applied to it. In this case, by a light bulb that's under, beneath it. And when the light is turned on and the interior matter is warmed up, it begins to move. Now here, now there, in ever-changing patterns. Oh, that is like psyche. When we are alive, when we are turned on, our own interiority comes to life. We cannot see it, we feel it. And that is psyche. Do you understand? And I wish I could share with you the aftershocks of that moment. The class came alive. The young woman herself laughed and reeled with understanding. And the rest of the quarter's work in that class was and remains one of the highlights of my teaching experience. And do you know what the class presented me with on the last day of class? Oh, yes, you do. A lava lamp. And I kept it in my office for the remaining years of teaching, and I eventually put it into my analytical office. And also, in that moment, Jung came alive for me in a way that I foolishly, intellectually thought I understood, but now I innerstood. For on the class syllabus, I had printed a statement of Jung. And the statement is, concepts are coined and negotiable values. Images are life. And this is from his magisterial Mysterium Coniunctionis. Now, interestingly, more recently, an astronomer with whom I've worked for many years asked me the same question. It was in an analytical session, and he was opposite me, and he said, what is psyche? And again, without thinking, I said, well, psyche is like quicksilver. You try to hold it in your hand. It moves now here, now there, now here and there. Ever changing, cannot be contained, elusive, and beautiful. And do you know what he did? He changed his name to Quicksilver for his analytical case. So, would you write down, please, now, my name is Quicksilver. And I wrote it down. An astronomer who is a cosmonaut and who became a psychonaut. Sailing, and it's from him that I have learned probably more about the relationship of interior space to outer space than from any other human being. The effortless interface between interiority and exteriority. But now it's time for a story. And we've got to come to the story of psyche. Well, we have some images that my own psychological life can be inert. We call that a depression. No heat. No movement. Or our life may be like a broken thermometer. The old-fashioned kind. And the quicksilver is all over it and cannot be brought back together. So the story of psyche, briefly, is a story of envy of one of the great goddesses, the goddess Aphrodite, about whom we'll hear a bit more later in the evening. For in the story of Psyche, we have three sisters. The story of Psyche will go through many, many, many transformations, and it will come out as Cinderella and other fairy tales and stories. But of the three sisters, Psyche is the most beautiful. And her sisters, who are not as beautiful, are at risk because of her beauty. And so her parents take and abandon her. And Aphrodite, who knows that Psyche is a direct challenge to Aphrodite's beauty, says to her son, Eros, you must kill her. Now you're hearing things suddenly like love kills. You are hearing things like beauty is something that cannot be tolerated if it is the object of envy. You are tracking this, aren't you? You're here now. So when Eros comes upon Aphrodite, he is so overwhelmed by her beauty that he falls in love with her himself and takes her to the very edge where love always takes us. And in a great leap, carries her to his home. But there's one problem. She must never look upon him. Are you hearing it? You cannot look at love. You are in love. Love is not an object. It's a subject. And she abides by this, but then her sisters appear because Psyche has become very homesick. And so it is arranged that the sisters will come, and they prod her by saying, well, how do you know it's not a monster? Well, we know this story by the story of Beauty and the Beast and other variations of this. How do you know it's not a monster? So, one night, fearful and trembling, she takes her oil lamp and approaches the bed that she shares with Eros. And her hand shakes, and the hot oil spills upon the skin. The image is neural pathways do it first. Always. Unless, he says, now I must leave you. All right, that's the frame. Now, because Eros is so beset with grief over the loss of Psyche, his mother Aphrodite says if she will perform some tasks and performs them in the time frame I give her, she will be reunited with you. And these were the tasks that she had to perform. Aphrodite threw down a mixture of millet seeds and poppy seeds. And in one night, she had to separate and retrieve those seeds. What to do? And ants came to her rescue. Because little tiny ants can always carry 3 and 4 times their own weight in their mouths. Are you tracking this? And so in the amount of time the two piles were established, and I remember a woman whose doctoral dissertation I was advising, and we were discussing this myth. And she looked up at me with tears and said, we have to pick up every seed, don't we? Yes. Every. Every. E-V-E-R-Y. Every seed. It's also a link to grieving. When we grieve, we first take up all the millet seeds but then to begin the poppy seeds. That's the task. So, what's the message? Work. Work hard. Work like an ant. And know that you're capable of carrying things many, many times your own perceived weight. You can do it. The problem is, we don't want to do it. How nice to have an analyst who would do it for you. Well, we'll take this one. We'll take this one. No, you have to do it. Second task. She is to return with golden fleece. She knows where the herd is of the golden fleece, but she is also adjured not to harm the beast. What to do? Answer. Do nothing. Wait. Observe. And after they have scratched themselves on the brambles and left, you can take the fleece that is left behind. First task, work hard. Second task, do nothing. Those are hard psychological tasks, aren't they? To know when to work hard and when to do nothing. And the third task, said Aphrodite, was to obtain water from Zeus's spring, the Empyrean spring. Well, how? It's beyond my grasp. It's beyond my reach. Answer. Ask for help. And Zeus comes in the form of an eagle, takes the container, flies up to the spring, fills it with water, and returns. Now, those are the three traditional tasks. Work hard, do nothing, but observe, wait. Those are hard things to do. And ask for help. Now, there is a fourth task, one that I came to appreciate a year or so ago when I was in Greece. The fourth task is to descend into Hades and return with a pomegranate seed. And to do that, you have to pay the price. You have to pay the price of the ferryman, to the ferryman. You have to take risks and return. Because if you do, if you go to the place of underground riches, you may return with the seed of renewal. We're in a profound wash of archetypal imagery. It was in Greece, it was, as a matter of fact, it was at Olympus, in a souvenir shop, in which there were these cast iron figures of the gods and goddesses. But the one that caught my attention was the god Hades, brother of Zeus and god of the underworld. And on a copper wire beside this black throne and black god is the three-headed dog Cerberus. Why three heads? Past, present, future. I folded back the little tag that described Hades, and it read, Hades, brother of Zeus, god of the underworld, and of the riches there that prevail. That's a very different image of Hades, isn't it? because it is an image of what we would call the unconscious. The sun god, the sea god, and the god of the underground. And at various sites in Greece, when you go to the Asclepian healing sites, always in those areas where the patients would sleep, there are holes next to the bed where the healing power of the serpent is expected to come up from the underground. That's a very different attitude about sky, water, and underground. So there we are. By surprising arrows. And by the way, after the three tasks, or the four, had been accomplished, she was reunited with Eros and admitted into the pantheon of immortality. Which, of course, is another psychological fact, that if death and resurrection were not a psychological reality, you could never project it upon a religion. Surprisingly, Psyche's tasks are the ones we face in analytical work. In psychoanalytical work, in daily life, in a lifetime of living. Sift, sort, know the difference between millet seeds and poppy seeds. Do nothing, observe, meditate, wait, bring no harm. Bring no harm. Go indirectly to the task. One is a direct approach to the task. The other is an indirect approach to the task. And third, ask for help. Perhaps for some, the very hardest of the tasks. We are over-educated to be self-reliant, self-sufficient, self-knowing. Not so. The water of life comes from a source beyond our reach. Be surprised. The phrase "be surprised" is very special to me, for I have a dear analyst friend who was very much smitten with one of our former analysts who has now died, but who lived for a time in Mount Vernon, Washington here. Dr. Arvind Vasavada, and my friend was sitting in his presence, projecting all this spirituality upon him, and he took out a pack of cigarettes and lighted the cigarette, and she said, "Why, Dr. Vasavada," she's from Mississippi, she said, "Why, Dr. Vasavada, I am surprised you are smoking. Be surprised. What else can you be? What else can you be? Be surprised. Where else can you be but where you are?" So it is psyche, soul, the richest sense of one's interiority that one must welcome for its surprises. Not only its surprises, but unexpected consequences as well. But first, our tendencies. And I'm going to give us four tendencies. The first you all know well, homo faber, work, for the night is coming. Work your ass off. Work. Provide. Work. And what are you going to do if you don't work? Homo faber. Work, work, work. Secondly, homo festivus. Learning how to be celebratory. We've all seen this in various ways, and I've had very special experiences of watching indigenous peoples in Southern Africa celebrate in glorious ways. who have a very different attitude about work, but not to celebrate. Thirdly, homo fantasia, to be in the play of fantasy, to be in the play of images. And fourthly, homo ludens, to be in the suppleness of play. Work, celebrate, be in the play of images, and be in the suppleness of play. I want to celebrate this evening particularly being in the play of images and to be in the suppleness of being. Yes, we know about work. And what do we know about work most? It's numbing. Yes, isn't it? He gave the punctuation to that. It's numbing. It can be benumbing. And we know about celebrating and its excesses. But in the words of Adam Phillips, a British psychoanalyst, a British Freudian, whose works I so admire, I want to share what he wrote with us because it's going to set the theme for the rest of the evening and tomorrow. So he's using the pronoun I, not I. I'm quoting Adam Phillips. I prefer the soul, the psyche, of men and women under psychoanalysis because psychoanalysis tells us a story about ourselves that both consoles and confounds us. It gives us a myth and a mystery, a coherent narrative and a disturbing incoherence simultaneously. At one fell swoop, our lives seem to make perfect sense and are perfectly senseless. We know ourselves, and we are always at our own unknowing, not to mention our own undoing. The other day, after an analytical session on the telephone, where this had taken place, where a personal narrative had crumbled under the weight of the unconscious truth. I called the individual back and read this, and this person said, with the greatest intensity I have ever heard, Jesus Christ. Our task, to put it in the words of Jung, is to taste the natural sweetness of life, what he called the chelum. To have this taste, as it were. Listen to the recipe that Jung provides for this taste in the Mysterium Coniunctionis. Now, he will use the word unconscious. I want us to think tonight, when we hear that word, of another phrase, concealed knowledge. What I don't know. Think the effortless movement of the lava lamp in its ever-changing forms. Think quicksilver, then return to the word unconscious as that of which we are not yet conscious. Jung's words are these. The recipe would run, take the unconscious in one of its handiest forms, say a spontaneous fantasy, homo fantasia, a dream, an irrational mood, an affect, or something of the kind, and operate with it. Give it your special attention. Concentrate on it. And observe its alterations objectively. Spare no effort to devote yourself to this task, follow the subsequent transformations of the spontaneous fantasy attentively and carefully. Above all, don't let anything from the outside that does not belong get into it, for the fantasy image has everything it needs. Now, the German word for this observing is betrachten, which in German carries the notion, colloquially as well, of becoming pregnant with meaning. To observe, to regard, to penetrate, to make pregnant within one, to be altered in consciousness. Betrachten. And I would add, be willing to be surprised. What else can you be? Be surprised. By the way, that moment changed this woman's life. You should hear the laughter as she tells the story. Taste the chelem and know what it means to be pregnant with light. So, to the tasks. First, Homo Ludens. What does it mean to keep in play? To remain flexible, to be spontaneous, to have an attitude that plays with the universe. I'd like to give you two very contrasting examples. One from the moment in the life of a 4-year-old boy, and the other from a playfulness that has enriched my own life and ours. First, the boy. A colleague of mine and I received a call from a mother who wanted us to work with a 4-year-old boy. His presenting problem was ankylosis. He was not and had not been capable for some time of voiding himself. Would we see him? Well, my colleague and I both talked and said we would, with the cooperation of a pediatrician. So the work began. Now, we were the new parents. I was the new father, she was the new mother. And we met in my Santre room. And this is what he would do. He would come for his session, and he would take his arm, and he would go down the shelves like this, and all the figures would be on the floor. Then he would go to the next shelf, and they'd all be on the floor. Then he would go over here to the other side of the room, run his arm, and all these figures came down. And I remember my colleague and I looked at each other. We had a hell of a cleanup every time he came for the first month or so. And then there was a change. And she suggested, he wanted a hut, so we took some chairs and a blanket, and we all, the three of us, went into this womb. Remember this, because this is going to come back before I'm through. And we began whispering and so forth and so on. And she said to him, is there anything you want to put into the Santre? Like, oh God, please say yes, you want to put something in the Santre. But is there anything you want to put in the sand? He said yes. So he began making his pictures in the sand. And one day, when things got very hairy, I didn't know what made me do it, but I walked over to the corner and I took out a bamboo pole and I gave one to him. I took one and I said, "En garde!" And I said, "Would you knock this from my hand?" And he went up. I said, "No, knock it from my hand." He tried and tried and finally gave it a whack and it went sailing across the room. Okay, that was one Saturday afternoon. In the intervening week, his father, took him to a swimming lesson. And as fate would have it, this particular day, they were to walk to the end of the board and just tumble into the water. And he walked to the end of the board, and he just stood there. Now, his father, who was a type A personality, said, "Jump. Jump, jump." And the boy turned and looked at his father and said, "I have lost my sword." The father was utterly confounded, did not know what he was talking about, called us in the middle of the week, said, "What's going on? Scotty has said he's lost his sword. What is he talking about?" Ah. How early can the transcendent function be activated? Try age 4. Example 2. This begins with really with the god Hermes. And among the many powers attributed to Hermes, 2 have been most pertinent to my own personal development. The first is that he's the god of moly. That is, he's the god of eloquence. And why is this important to me? Because I was a severe stutterer. At age 8, I could not get a sentence out. My cousin, who was a nurse, was visiting one day, and she tossed a ball, and I caught it with my left hand, and she turned to my mother and said, "Why, Aunt Sophie, I think Leland is left-handed." And that turned things around. And I found my own eloquence. And I've been at it now for 75 years. Okay. Hermes. Eloquence. 2. He's also the god of the sudden find. When we're walking along and we see something in our way, we have to enter, if we're at all conscious, the spirit of Betrachten in order to be surprised. So I brought along some of my favorite little objects that I'd like to share with you and how they are meaningful to me. And I don't care if they don't mean a goddamn thing to you. They mean a lot to me, okay? All right. One day, when I was walking along, and it will speak for itself, feeling a bit pressed upon by life, I found this can of Orange Crush. And it was at that moment, in that moment of Betrachten, yes, and I reached down into the gutter and picked it up. And I've had it ever since, because there isn't a person in this room who doesn't know what this feels like. This one really caught my attention, because I was walking along near the university and found this Budweiser can, but it's been crippled and smashed in such a way that it says Weiser Bud. And the answer is, yeah, because that's what I was called. I was called Bud. I was called Buddy. Weiser Bud? Yeah. Betrachten. Observe. Be surprised. I shared a course with a colleague of mine. And we were talking about found art, and he said there's no such thing as found art, and this is a class of about 300 people, and he said, "I will give you $10, and I hadn't gone very far when I found this gorgeous mandala, this lid from a can that is gorgeous, rich, rusted, golden, betrachten. It's not just a piece of trash. Once it's picked up and isolated, it becomes something else. And I found for my class the mask of the god of tragedy. Oh, it's just a tin can that rusted. Look, your lava lamp is non. You have to turn your lava lamp on. Oh, there will be no surprises. Yes? Well, for the past few years, I've been working with this remarkable professional woman who is in the arts. And I would say, I just had to characterize it, she's been dealing with a broken heart. So one day, when she was down in Indiana, walking along the shores of Lake Michigan, she found this object. She picked it up and brought it to her analysis and said, I want to leave it here. I think it's over. She had that moment of betrachten she was filled with in her life. For she found this stone that is the image of her wounded heart. And I have kept it faithfully. And I sent her an email and told her I was sharing it tonight. So that's the sudden find. And when we have these moments of betrachten, we have our own enthusiasm. And the word enthusiasm literally means the God within, the enthusioi. When you are enthusiastic about anything, whatever that thing is the God that's speaking to you. Now, Adam Phillips also quotes Freud at this moment. He writes, happiness, Freud wrote in Civilization and Its Discontents, is something utterly subjective. Not only is our pleasure idiosyncratic, it is revealing of our idiosyncrasy. If you really want to find out who you are, recognize what makes you happy. Your subjectivity, Freud suggests, is your happiness. Are you all okay? Can we go on? Okay. Second, Homo Fantasia. To be witness to the ever-unfolding surprises that psyche renders into consciousness if we but follow them. To be imaginative is to be in the spirit of imagination. Don't ever mispronounce that word again. You don't have an imagination. You have an imagination. When you are entertained, you are being entertained by images, either on the screen, in life, in the gutter, wherever you find that which brings you pleasure. One will be in the flow of images through dreams, of course, and through waking imaginings. So I'm going to tell you a personal story that came out of a dream, went onto paper, and into at least 20 years of doodling. I must have been about 12 years old. That would be 1939. And I dreamt that I had seen the germ that would kill infantile paralysis. That's what it was called. The President of the United States had infantile paralysis, and every schoolboy knew about infantile paralysis. The beaches are closed, the pools are closed, watchfulness is all. And into the unconscious, and given a life for over 20 years, came this image. And of course, it looked a bit like an amoeba with a center. Now, sitting by the shores on Vancouver Island one summer when I was teaching up at the University of Victoria, and reading Edinger and the nature of the transcendent function, of which I knew a lot intellectually, but discovered or rediscovered or had the moment of betrachting in the authority of the doodle for what I would do. If I were talking on the telephone, I did this now for over 20 years. made no connection, none, to the dream. Never. Never made a connection. I would do this, and then I would do this. Now, over time, it developed into something like this, and then it had this, and then it had a face. And it looked like a sun figure. And this image, which I must have doodled hundreds and hundreds of times, unconsciously, surprised me one day in reading Edinger that I had doodled the answer to overcoming my own infantile paralysis. Not that I had infantile paralysis, but I had infantile paralysis. That story. Another moment that came in an analytical hour, when I was so totally surprised, I was stunned. I had been working with this woman for some time. She was a concert pianist from Europe, and she had this experience on Italian radio, pianist, of playing a concerto and lost her way in the middle of the concert. And that was flying back to her home in Chicago, she came and began a very long, intensive work. And the dream that propelled us into another place was a dream in which a blue goose fell at her feet. And the story of the blue goose is her private story, which she found an actual ceramic image of, which is in my sanitary room presently. But when the work was clearly ebbing, and her concertizing had long begun again, there was a long pause. And she closed her eyes. To be altered in consciousness, betrachten, and I would add, be willing to be surprised. What else can you be? Be surprised. By the way, that moment changed this woman's life. You should hear the laughter as she tells the story. Taste the chelum and know what it means to be pregnant with light. So, to the tasks. First, Homo Ludens. What does it mean to keep in play? To remain flexible, to be spontaneous, to have an attitude that plays with the universe. I'd like to give you two very contrasting examples. One from the moment in the life of a 4-year-old boy, and the other from a playfulness that has enriched my own life and ours. First, the boy. A colleague of mine and I received a call from a mother who wanted us to work with a 4-year-old boy.
His presenting problem was encopresis. He was not and had not been capable for some time of voiding himself. Would we see him? Well, my colleague and I both talked and said we would, with the cooperation of a pediatrician. So the work began. Now, we were the new parents. I was the new father, she was the new mother. And we met in my Santre room. And this is what he would do. He would come for his session, and he would take his arm, and he would go down the shelves like this, and all the figures would be on the floor. Then he would go to the next shelf, and they'd all be on the floor. Then he would go over here to the other side of the room, run his arm, and all these figures came down. And I remember my colleague and I looked at each other. We had a hell of a cleanup every time he came for the first month or so. And then there was a change. And she suggested, he wanted a hut, so we took some chairs and a blanket, and we all, three of us, went into this womb. Remember this, because this is going to come back before I'm through. And we began whispering and so forth and so on. And she said to him, is there anything you want to put into the sand tray? Like, oh God, please say yes, you want to put something in the sand tray. But is there anything you want to put in the sand? He said yes. So he began making his pictures in the sand. And one day, when things got very hairy, I didn't know what made me do it, but I walked over to the corner and I took out a bamboo pole and I gave one to him. I took one and I said, "En garde!" And I said, "Would you knock this from my hand?" And he went up. I said, "No, knock it from my hand." He tried and finally gave it a whack and it went sailing across the room. Okay, that was one Saturday afternoon. In the intervening week, his father took him to a swimming lesson. And as fate would have it, this particular day, they were to walk to the end of the board and just tumble into the water. And he walked to the end of the board, and he just stood there. Now, his father, who was a type A personality, said, "Jump! Jump! Jump!" And the boy turned and looked at his father and said, "I have lost my sword." Father was utterly confounded, did not know what he was talking about, called us in the middle of the week, said, "What's going on? Scotty has said he's lost his sword. What is he talking about?" How early can the transcendent function be activated? Try age 4. Example 2. This begins with the god Hermes. And among the many powers attributed to Hermes, two have been most pertinent to my own personal development. The first is that he's the god of moly. That is, he's the god of eloquence. And why is this important to me? Because I was a severe stutterer. At age 8, I could not get a sentence out. My cousin, who was a nurse, was visiting one day, and she tossed a ball, and I caught it with my left hand, and she turned to my mother and said, "Why, Aunt Sophie, I think Leland is left-handed." And that turned things around. And I found my own eloquence. And I've been at it now for 75 years. Okay. Hermes. Eloquence. Two. He's also the god of the sudden find. When we're walking along and we see something in our way, we have to enter, if we're at all conscious, the spirit of Betrachten in order to be surprised. So I brought along some of my favorite little objects that I'd like to share with you and how they are meaningful to me. And I don't care if they don't mean a goddamn thing to you. They mean a lot to me, okay? All right. One day when I was walking along, and it will speak for itself, feeling a bit pressed upon by life, I found this can of Orange Crush. And it was at that moment, in that moment of Betrachten, yes, and I reached down into the gutter and picked it up. And I've had it ever since, because there isn't a person in this room who doesn't know what this feels like. This one really caught my attention, because I was walking along near the university and found this Budweiser can, but it's been crippled and smashed in such a way that it says Weiser Bud. And the answer is, yeah, because that's what I was called. I was called Bud. I was called Buddy. Weiser Bud? Yeah. Betrachten. Observe. Be surprised. I shared a course with a colleague of mine. And we were talking about found art, and he said, there's no such thing as found art. And this is a class of about 300 people. And he said, I will give you $10. And I hadn't gone very far when I found this gorgeous mandala, this lid from a can that is gorgeous, rich, rusted, golden, Betrachten. It's not just a piece of trash. Once it's picked up and isolated, it becomes something else. And I found for my class the mask of the god of tragedy. Oh, it's just a tin can that rusted. Look, your lava lamp is non. You have to turn your lava lamp on. Oh, there will be no surprises. Yes? Well, for the past few years, I've been working with this remarkable professional woman who is in the arts. And I would say, if I just had to characterize it, she's been dealing with a broken heart. So one day, when she was down in Indiana, walking along the shores of Lake Michigan, she found this object. She picked it up and brought it to her analysis and said, I want to leave it here. I think it's over. She had that moment of Betrachten. She was filled within her life. For she found this stone that is the image of her wounded heart. And I have kept it faithfully. And I sent her an email and told her I was sharing tonight. So that's the sudden find. And when we have these moments of Betrachtet, we have our own enthusiasm. And the word enthusiasm literally means the God within, the enthusioi. When you are enthusiastic about anything, whatever that thing is the God that's speaking to you. Now, Adam Phillips also quotes Freud at this moment. He writes, "Happiness," Freud wrote in Civilization and Its Discontents, "is something utterly subjective. Not only is our pleasure idiosyncratic, it is revealing of our idiosyncrasy. If you really want to find out who you are, recognize what makes you happy. Your subjectivity," Freud suggests, "is your happiness." Are you all okay? Can we go on? Okay. Second, homophantasia. To be witness to the ever-unfolding surprises that psyche renders into consciousness if we but follow them. To be imaginative is to be in the spirit of imagination. Don't ever mispronounce that word again. You don't have an imagination. You have an imagination. When you are entertained, you are being entertained by images, either on the screen, in life, in the gutter, wherever you find that which brings you pleasure. One will be in the flow of images through dreams, of course, and through waking imaginings. So I'm going to tell you a personal story that came out of a dream, went onto paper, and into at least 20 years of doodling. I must have been about 12 years old. That would be 1939. And I dreamt that I had seen the germ that would kill infantile paralysis. That's what it was called. The President of the United States had infantile paralysis, and every schoolboy knew about infantile paralysis. The beaches are closed, the pools are closed, watchfulness is all. And into the unconscious, and given a life for over 20 years, came this image. And of course, it looked a bit like an amoeba with a center. Now, sitting by the shores on Vancouver Island one summer when I was teaching up at the University of Victoria and reading Edinger and the nature of the transcendent function, of which I knew a lot intellectually, but discovered or rediscovered or had the moment of Betrachten in the authority of the doodle. For what I would do, if I were talking on the telephone, I did this now for over 20 years. made no connection, none, to the dream. Never. Never made a connection. I would do this, and then I would do this. Now, over time, it developed into something like this, and then it had this, and then it had a face. And it looked like a sun figure. And this image, which I must have doodled hundreds and hundreds of times, unconsciously, surprised me one day in reading Edinger that I had doodled the answer to overcoming my own infantile paralysis. Not that I had infantile paralysis, but I had infantile paralysis. That story. Another moment that came in an analytical hour, when I was so totally surprised, I was stunned. I had been working with this woman for some time. She was a concert pianist from Europe, and she had this experience on Italian radio, pianist, of playing a concerto and lost her way in the middle of the concert. And that was flying back to her home in Chicago. She came and began a very long, intensive work. And the dream that propelled us into another place was a dream in which a blue goose fell at her feet. And the story of the blue goose is her private story, which she found an actual ceramic image of, which is in my sanitary room presently. But when the work was clearly ebbing, and her concertizing had long begun again, there was a long pause. And she closed her eyes. And this is what she said. We work in the dark. We do what we can. We give what we can. Our doubt is our passion. Our passion is our task. The rest is the mystery of art. Who said that? Oh, Henry James, she said. I think you've got it. The astronomer presented me with exactly the same moment. There was this long pause, and out of the silence, he said, I tried to conquer the universe, and it defeated me. I tried to capture the universe, but it eluded me. I tried to understand the universe, but it outwitted me. So clumsily, hesitantly, I tried to love the universe, and it embraced me. Who wrote that? And he said, Sig Paulsen. And I wish I had the picture that amplifies this, but I haven't received it yet. He's promised to send it. So finally, the astronomer could abandon the utter necessity for reasons and concepts for the elusive image of the cosmos as given in the response to the ineffable. As Henri Corbin has observed, imagination mediates between the visible and the invisible world. And let me give you some examples. Remember I said, don't forget Aphrodite. You will remember that Aphrodite's birth came when Cronos came upon Uranus, severed the testicles of Uranus, and tossed them into the Aegean. There was this huge fomenting foam. Out of the foam came Aphrodite, coming to the shore. And that's the birth of Aphrodite. thousands of years later, a man is sitting in an analytical chamber, and he's presenting this dream. The dream was exactly one sentence. I'm walking along the shoreline of a beach, and I'm kicking the foam. Oh, my God, I thought, this is it. This is the whole thing. He'd been having a long, adulterous affair, and it was wrecking his marriage and his life. And the Greek word for foam, which we use, by the way, to prevent conception, the Greek word for foam is aphros, as in the word Aphrodite. And he had been kicking love around. The dream appeared so innocuous. And how can an analyst encourage betrachten if the individual doesn't want to see the mystery of the dream? Well, that's a professional question, and I don't have the answer for it. Do you, Peter? Well, imagine his surprise of what Psyche surprised him with, the truth of his life. But the one that I have been the most fascinated with over the years was that when I became an analyst, I made an agreement with the university that I would see students who came to me free of charge. And I got a call one day, would I see this young man? And yes, I would see him. And he came to my office and he said, you know, I have this problem. A very, very Northwestern type. I have this problem. I don't know whether I want to be an artist or a lawyer. Can you help me? And, okay, so we began talking. And what emerged was, when I asked about his family, was that he was the oldest sibling in a family of about 8. And he was adopted, and so were the other 7. And among the other 7 were Asians, African Americans, Hispanics, and he was the Anglo. And then the question turned, as things really got serious, he wanted to know about his parents. Well, it just so happens that the state in which he resided at the time had an agency to which you could write, and you could receive from the agency a profile of the parents and circumstances surrounding the birth. That is to say, just biographical profile. Well, you know the story, don't you? His mother was an artist and his father was a lawyer. Be surprised. He came with the problem that he didn't know what the problem was. He stated the truth. I don't know what is to become of me. Your mother was an artist, and your father was a lawyer. And in subsequent years, he has found his birth mother and has established a relationship with her. It's a remarkable story. Well, then we have the last of this, being surprised. I got a call from a fellow analyst, would I see this person, because the individual had had a very nasty dream about the analyst he was seeing at the time, but couldn't share the dream with the analyst he was seeing. So would I see this person? I said yes, and I did. And I'm really going to cut to the quick here. Because lo and behold, it turned out that he was adopted. And the dream about the animals had long since faded away. So in this particular state, he could write for his birth certificate. And when he did, and when he got it, he couldn't open it. He brought it to the session. He said, could we open it together? I said, yes. He opened it, and I looked at him. He went white. Well, the name of his father was the same name as his analyst. Not the analyst, but the same name. He had it all right and all wrong. But he knew. Two remarkable stories. But as Adam Phillips puts it, our sanity is in our punctuation. Recently, the wife of an analysand of mine died, and I went to her funeral. I had known her only through the attitudes of her husband. Sitting in this Episcopal service, which was magnificent, her love of music, the choral singing, and then the rector read this, what I'm going to share with you, and I went into what Joseph Campbell used to call aesthetic arrest. It's Henri Nguyen wrote this. This was one of her favorite stories. Recently, a friend told me about a pair of twins talking to each other in the womb. The sister said to the brother, I believe there is life after birth. Her brother protested vehemently. No, 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 this is all there is. This is a dark and cozy place, and we have nothing else to do but cling to the cord that feeds us. The little girl, however, insisted. There must be something else, a place with light, where there is freedom to move. Still, she could not convince her twin. After some silence, the sister continued hesitantly, I have something else to say, but you probably won't believe that either. But I think there is a mother. Her brother became furious. A mother? What are you talking about? I've never seen a mother, and neither have you. Who put that idea into your head? As I told you, this is the place, and it's all we have. Why do you always want more? The sister was quite overwhelmed by her brother's response, and for quite a while didn't dare say anything more. But she couldn't let go of her thoughts, and since she had only her twin brother to speak to, she finally said, do you feel these squeezes every once in a while? They're quite unpleasant and even painful. Yes, but what's so special about that? Well, the sister said, I think that these squeezes are to get us ready for another place, and more beautiful than this, where we will see our mother face to face. I'm sure that many of you have seen the film Many and Alexander, the film by Bergman. This is a copy of a still from that film. Alexander is deep in play in his homo fantasia with his little theater figures. If you will note on the proscenium arch, perhaps you can't read it from where you are, there is a phrase in Danish. And it's always in Danish
in Scandinavian theaters, whether it's in Oslo or Stockholm or Copenhagen. And the phrase is, I bloat to least. Now, I had the privilege of sitting in the Danish Opera House, and I looked up, and here was this phrase, I bloat to least. And it means, in the freest of translations, not just for entertainment. Dreams are not just for entertainment. This lecture is not just to be entertained. I bloat to least. Being surprised by and with the dialogue of the soul. And finally, the nature of poesis and its relationship to fantasia. I'm just going to read three short poems to you. Then we'll take our break and come back and look at each other. The first is by our poet laureate, Billy Collins. This is one of my favorite poems. I can't tell you how many times I have read it in analysis. It's called One Life to Live. This is the only life I have, this one in my head, the one that travels along the surface of my body, singing the low voltage song of the ego, the one that feels like a ball between my ears sometimes and other times feels absolutely galactic, the life that my feet carry around like two blind scholars working together on a troublesome manuscript. This is the only life I have, and I am standing dead in the center of it like a man doing a rope trick in a rodeo, passing the lasso over his head, over his body, smiling inside a twirling of ovals and ellipses. This is the only life I have, and I never step out of it except to follow a character down the alleys of a novel, or when love makes me want to remove my clothes and sail classical records off a cliff. Otherwise, you can always find me within this hoop of myself, the rope flying around me, moving up to encircle my head like an equator, or a halo, or a zero. The next poem is by Pablo Neruda, and it's really kind of a summary of tonight's reflections. And it's entitled, We Are Many. Of the many men whom I am, whom we are, I cannot settle on a single one. They are lost to me under the cover of clothing. They have departed for another city. When everything seems to be set to show me off as a man of intelligence, the fool I keep concealed on my person takes over my talk and occupies my mouth. On other occasions, I'm dozing in the midst of people of some distinction. And when I summon my courageous self, a coward completely unknown to me swaddles my poor skeleton in a thousand tiny reservations. When a stately home bursts into flames, instead of the fireman I summon, an arsonist bursts on the scene, and he is I. There is nothing I can do. What must I do to distinguish myself? How can I put myself together? All the books I read, lionized, dazzling hero figures, always brimming with self-assurance, I die with envy of them. And in films where bullets fly on the wind, I'm left in the envy of the cowboys, left admiring even the horses. But when I call upon my dashing being, out comes the same old lazy self. So I never know who I am, nor how many I am, nor who we will be being. I would like to be able to touch a bell and call up my real self, the truly me, because if I really need my proper self, I must not allow myself to disappear.
While I'm writing, I'm far away, and when I come back, I've already left. I should like to see if the same thing happens to other people as it does to me, to see as if as many people are as I am, and if they seem the same way to themselves. When this problem has been thoroughly explored, I'm going to school myself so well in things that when I try to explain my problems, I shall speak not of the self, but of geography.
A comment about how it was to work on a script and then play the lead in it. Daunting. Very much so. I read everything available on Stieglitz and O'Keefe. Everything that was either a letter or a journal or a conversation that was reported, I copied. I then winnowed these into a coherent arc of time. Because, among other things, this was to be presented to high school students in the city of Chicago for quite a long period of time, where they would come at 10 o'clock in the morning or noon or 1 o'clock. And the task of the director of this was to give some understanding of Stieglitz's art, his notion of photography, let's say. Well, it was both for the general audience of the Art Institute as well as, it was quite a range, you see. And I was very fortunate to work with a woman who played Georgia O'Keeffe, and we're close friends, and it made it, and we worked together because she could see Stieglitz in a way that I couldn't, and I could see O'Keeffe in a way that she couldn't. So it worked out over a long period of time, and then we were ready to do it. And then I commissioned a score for it. So then there were the Stieglitz theme, the O'Keeffe theme, the intertwining themes of O'Keeffe and Stieglitz, and so on. It was quite an experience. Yeah, definitely. Observations, comments, questions? Partly, but it's just that what awakens us is often at an intensity or a level of intensity that is beyond the parameters of the life or lives we might be living at the moment. And, you know, in order to get your attention, it takes a hell of a lot to do. So recurrent dreams are always important. Dreams that frighten or awaken are important. You know, what's your earliest dream? That kind of thing. I'm not in the pathology model, so you know, I'm stepping outside that. We're not here to pathologize the nature of dreams, but to acknowledge their presence in psyche. I mean, psyche was terrified. Can you imagine the tasks that she was forced to perform? Every single seat. Well, how can I? I'm to bring no harm to these. What am I to do? Do nothing. To be reunited. You get it? To be reunited with Eros. You have a lot to do. So maybe just being numb and dumb is better than going after it. Yes, right. What is psychic? Well, can you be played for just a moment? All right. I was working with this woman one time, and she must have been maybe 60, 62, someplace. And all she wanted at one point, and this was her word, she wanted to be cute again. Cute. And there was a long pause, and I looked her straight in the eye, and I said, "You're too old to be cute." Hard, but necessary. I really said that. I mean, we both laughed, but you have to say something. Yes, someone. Yes. Yes. Mm. Mm-hmm. Giant ants. Right? Yes, the invasion of the ants. But the problem is, you have to carry 3 times your own weight. And that is hard. The metaphor of the ant is critical. Of what it does, it's industrious. Yeah. Well, you've been a wonderful audience. Sleep, dream. And I think I'll see some of you tomorrow and be surprised. Bye-bye.
I want Dr. Orloff to do an ovation. Well, is there anything that people need to bring for tomorrow?
Pencil and paper.
Okay. And we start tomorrow at 10. And I just want to thank you again for this wonderful evening, and we're just really looking forward to tomorrow. And I see a hand.
Yes. Yes.
That's an excellent question. We usually do 10 to 2:30 with a half hour for lunch. So we have some snacks, but the recommendation is to bring a brown bag because, you know, to
I will also.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.